Hey there, everybody. Thank you for checking out the Broke Down Podcast. This is episode 71. My name is Jonathan. I am your host, and I'm glad to be here with side two of our celebration of the 50th birthday of Working Man's Dead with Buzz Poole. I would like to thank everyone for the warm reception and kind response to side A. I think you'll enjoy what we have in store for you today. First up, I'd like to remind you that the Broke Down Podcast is a member of Osiris. Osiris Media is connecting you with music and culture that you love through podcasts, live streams, and more. There's a new show from Osiris called Past, Present, and Future Live. It's a weekly show that tells the story of an artist's musical journey. Every episode closes with a live original performance. At the time I'm recording this, the first couple episodes are up. There should be a new one this week, though. The first two feature Eric Krasno and Rhett Miller. You can find Past, Present, and Future Live and so many more great things at osirispod.com. Okay, I'm not going to waste any time. My guest, once again, is, as I mentioned, writer Buzz Poole, who penned the terrific book On Working Man's Dead for Bloomsbury's 33 and a Third series, which you may know looks at a different album for each book in the series. You can find this book basically anywhere the books are sold, so check your local independent bookseller or head to 333sound.com to find it. We broke down side A last time, so now we shall carry on to side two, and after that we've got a mix of solid versions of these tunes, so please stay on board for that. There might even be a surprise for those of you who hang in for the whole thing. And last thing before I let you go, I will remind you that you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BrokeDownPod. The full show notes with links and track listings are always at BrokeDownPodcast.blogspot.com. And please, don't hesitate to send your metaphorical cards and letters. I love to hear from you, and I may even spin up the old mailbag soon. So now, let's flip over Working Man's Dead and get into side two. Until next time, be well. So we're here for side two of Working Man's Dead. And when we wrapped side one, you spoke about how they were kind of purposefully making a folk album. And, you know, one of the things, or a couple of the things that folk artists, folk musicians do, particularly the ones that the band would have been looking back to and influenced by, they make reference to history, they spin old tales, but they make them fresh because they're also telling the daily news through these songs. They're talking about their current times, even if they are couching it in somewhere else, somewhere past, a song handed down. And I could think of no more perfect example of that than the first song on this side. So let's play everybody a little bit of this and get right into side two.
I can't stay much longer, Melinda.
So yeah, that was 1970 for 1570 Cumberland Blues. And like I said, I think this is just a cool example of the Dead telling who they are and where they are, even though they are not coal miners.
They certainly aren't.
They were working a job. And honestly, were it not for music, most of these guys probably would have been, and some of them before they got into this, were just workaday guys. So
they all were, with the exception of Weir.
Guess that's because he was in high school when he started.
Right. Even back then, the labor laws wouldn't have let him. Well, he could have gone into the mines, but no, they all, you know, both Mickey Hart and Garcia were in the armed forces. Kreutzmann worked in a wig shop, taught drum lessons. Phil Lesh was a mail carrier.
Yeah. I love Phil's telling in his book about driving the mail truck, listening to Bob Dylan blasting on his little tape deck. You know? Yeah. So they were workaday guys. And here we have a song that is so workaday that there's the old story about the miner who said, the old miner who they took this song from probably be pretty upset or whatever. I can't get the quote because I don't know it, but
I think that's basically it. And it's Hunter's the greatest compliment Hunter ever got. You know, that's right. I remember reading that in Long Strange Trip, McNally's book about about the band. And right, because they get that mood, you know, that idea that, you know, have to walk the line just to pay my union dues. That is as resonant today as it was then. That this idea that you're stuck in this job that you don't like, and you're only doing it to basically just keep working. And it's something the band knew from their own experiences, and they also knew that they could deviate from that norm. They could take this detour from the straight life, and that's what they had been doing since forming the band in 1965. And certainly, at this point, they had kind of figured out ways to do it to try to keep that high time that we were talking about earlier on the A side, of, you know, not that they were getting rich in the way that they certainly did get rich, starting in the late 80s, but that they could live on their own terms, and they could stay happy, and they could stay fed, and they could stay lubricated, and they could stay with all the new gear they wanted. They could, you know, we're getting into this time when their, you know, Grateful Dead Records is becoming a thing, and they are figuring out ways to do things on their own terms and to be totally unapologetic about it. And that is, I think, what Cumberland Blues really represents when you look at the entire arc of Grateful Dead history, is taking what had been maybe like a half-baked, like, oh, we could just be a rock band and get high and travel around and have fun, it'll be great, to how do we really do this? And the way they do it is start your own record label. Now, that was not successful, but it was at least the right mindset.
Yeah, something, you know. It's a thing that played out, and it the fact that it happened and it, you know, they got records out is in a way a version of success.
Absolutely. And you know, and I think it's worth mentioning that even something the Dead did when they first signed with Warner Brothers was insisting on keeping their publishing rights, which was unheard of at this time. And it is essential to understanding the Dead of being able to keep control of their creative output. Many artists, and certainly back in the 60s, many artists did not have the wherewithal to even think that this such a thing was important. And the Dead recognized it, that they always want to do things on their own terms. And so now you flash forward a few years and they have a bit more leverage, industry leverage, not much, but some. And certainly with Working Man's Dead, their leverage increased because this was their first album that had the potential for the song radio play, namely Uncle John's Band and Casey Jones. And they started making more and more decisions that were about not having to go back to the mine. And so that was starting their own merchandising, later on starting their own ticketing. It was about keeping things under their control, so that whatever decisions they made, they live or die by those decisions, but they did it as a band, as a family, as a company that was looking out for their own interests on their own terms, with no outside stakeholders really having much sway.
Yeah, you talk a good bit about this in the book, and you know, this is they're in their like most working man state here. So right soon after this song is coming to be, or in that time zones when Lenny Hartz fleeced the band, and then they throw themselves into the workaday life. They draft Cutler to be their tour manager, and they say, "How do we make money doing this? Because we don't have any money. We need to make some money doing this." They're not trying to get rich. They're just trying to get on to the next thing, as I keep saying, you know. So and Cutler, he puts them out there on the road, and they play the most dates of any year at that point, in 70, that they work the road to death. Garcia is not interested in even that straight life interface, so you know, they replace Lenny Hart with somebody else, and they get somebody else to do, you know, the front office and somebody to take care of the money. And, you know, they've got the lawyer, and then they've, you know, they just bring in the people that they think they can trust. And, you know, some are great, and some are less great, and you know, some have longer tenures than others. Even Sam Cutler doesn't stick around forever, but in the process, he starts a touring company, you know, putting other groups on the road, and they start a travel agency because they become experts in booking travel, and they really the little cottage industry just grows around this group. Their business model becomes kind of equally admired and dismissed for decades after this. And it's, you sum it up neatly in the closing of the chapter when you note that they evade becoming the miners by becoming the mine.
And I think that's a really important point too, is that, you know, the, in this Working Man's Dead era, it really was a family affair, and they are, you know, they're aboard, and everyone has in the band has equal vote. And a lot of the crew, you know, the crew was treated very, very well. And the staff, and as the organization grew, there were more and more people who the core members of the band considered family, and they treated better than probably most bands treat any of their teams. And that's part of that dependent, that kind of, you know, when the Dead talk about the kind of, it became this lumbering beast, and where, you know, addiction and just road wear took its toll. That idea of not being able to stop is because they had all these mouths to feed, essentially. But at the beginning, it's essential to understand that they had the best intentions in mind. And that even I think in the end they had good intentions. Probably made some bad decisions with those good intentions, but these little, as you said, cottage industries are important because they were doing it, and they were just trying to figure out ways to not have to deal with a record label more than they had to. I mean, they really just wanted, and that's why they started Grateful Dead Records, you know. And then they had this deal with, I believe it's Warner Brothers, to just be their, like, their fulfillment house, their distributor, you know. And then, of course, the best example of it is Grateful Dead ticketing.
Yeah.
But even in with Skull and Roses, when they released it in 1971, you also have this call to arms about, you know, Deadheads, where are you? Who are you? We want to hear from you. And that's another really important thing going on here, is that the Dead, in many ways, were very much like the Deadheads, because the Deadheads were also looking for a good time. They were looking for something that the establishment was not necessarily offering them, and that they would go to a Grateful Dead show and they'd recognize and meet and engage with like minds, both in the audience and on stage, and that there is this camaraderie and this kind of peers in a way that the Dead, you know, they weren't doing it because someone told them to go do your market research, you know, find out your demographic, let's get the demographics down and figure out, you know, how we can best sell to these people. That was not where these decisions came from. It was about, it's a horrible, I'm going to use the word, but because I can't think of a better one right now, but it is organic. And it was something that they did because they were sitting around bullshitting about things to do. And they said, why don't we try it like this? And so many of the things that the Dead tried like this are, you now you see emulated today, you know, whether, you know, and even the pay-per-view specials, like when the Dead would do the live broadcasts from on Halloween from Radio City Music Hall, or you know, like these are right. All things now today, or the ticketing, the comedians do it, rock bands do it. It's all industry standard now, and the Dead were the standard bearers on it, and it's remarkable. And it was all in the name of not having to go down to the mine, until that they really did become the mine, because they had so many people who were dependent on them for their livelihoods, and they felt that pressure. But that, you know, isn't until the 90s.
Yeah. And I think the, use the word organic, I don't think it's a bad word, because I think it really fits, but there is this connection with the Deadheads, both in the audience with the band and with one another, that has not only not only fueled these projects for the band, but it fueled so many other projects outside the band. You know, people started magazines, people started podcasts, people write books, all of these things that just make sense. And yeah, people write books about other bands, but the fan connections, the connection between the people who do these things is very different. We experience it right here, right now. The whole reason I do this is because it shoots through so much of our culture that I can talk to people who play any kind of music and find out that they're into this kind of music as well. And that all extends from that work.
Absolutely. And you know, it's because the Dead were Mickey Hart famously says they're in the travel business, right? Yeah. They it's an experience, and it's a concert. And everyone was different, as we all know. Whereas the idea of, you know, a show where you go see a band show, and if you saw them in Philadelphia, it'd be pretty much the same if you saw them in DC, if you saw them in Chicago. And so not that to take away from that, but it's just a different experience. And that's what the Dead and the Deadheads absolutely shared in common, was the hunger for that next new experience. And again, that's what we were talking about. That's the on the road. That's right. That mentality of that it is all in the now, and that there's no reason to get caught up in the past, because the past is past, and what lies ahead, we don't know. But that's why we're, you know, to borrow from a Working Man's Dead song, you know, I don't know what I'm going for, but I'm going to go. That's for sure. It's just like, it's that forward momentum. And that's the magic of it. I mean, and that's what kept that's what keeps the whole thing humming, as you say. Yeah. And it goes way beyond the band and its music now, which is remarkable. And in the same way, and that goes back to that idea of this being a folk album. You know, I'm not talking about folk music in terms of musical theory. I'm talking about it as a repurposing of traditions. And this long tradition of that repurposing of tradition, which I think is unquestionably what was happening with this album, and what the Dead, you know, what the Dead did throughout their career.
So you said something a minute ago that I'm gonna hang on to here real quick, because you said we don't know what's coming, but there's one thing that we know is coming. It's one thing we know is coming, and we talk about it in our next song. So we're going to go ahead and advance to the next track here. So yeah, you can hear the full version of that there on Dave's Picks 33. This is, of course, Black Peter. And the one thing that we all know is coming is the end, right? It happens. It's the one of those guarantees. I have to start this by calling you out a little bit. In the very beginning of this chapter, you said you are not a fan, or let me rephrase this. You going into this project, you were not a fan of Black Peter. And I, for a minute, almost put down the book. I was like, I can't do it. What?
You know, and sorry.
Yeah, no, it did leave me without words for a little bit. But even still, you make a good case for the value of this song. I can make a good case for the value of this song, but you actually, I think coming from your that perspective, you actually bring something into this that I never would have considered. And which is you start talking about an artist, a painter and drawing parallels between his work and this song. And you know, this may not be the best medium to discuss painting, but well, maybe to discuss it, but we may not be able to capture it as well. But talk to me a little bit about this.
So any excuse to mention Charles Birchfield to people, I will take up in a heartbeat. And he was a Ohio painter who spent a great deal of time in upstate New York, and was painting in the 20s and 30s, well before the notion of psychedelics or psychedelic culture had entered culture. And his great focus was the cycles of nature and being able to capture those with what is quite enlivened watercolors of forests, of lakes, of the natural world constantly in transition. Some of Birchfield's greatest work portrays all four seasons kind of happening simultaneously. For me, this is what's going on with Black Peter. Black Peter is a examination of life as something that is intimately and inevitably connected to death. And, you know, Jonathan, you had mentioned, you know, I read that note in the doc we had going for this. And I started thinking about that because, you know, I have come to appreciate the song so much more, but I'll tell you what I realized now is that I think I didn't like it because of all I did love about the Grateful Dead, both in terms of hearing it on bootlegs, sitting in my bedroom as a 14-year-old, and going to shows as a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old, whatever. I think Black Peter is an incredibly nuanced song that a teenager can't, I as a teenager could not appreciate because I wasn't worried about death. And I'm not worried about it now, but I wasn't, my relationship to it is not what it is today as someone who's 43. And so I really was mulling this over because even these great versions, like the 77 version or, you know, any of them where Garcia just really kicks in and it has the same power of a morning dew, which I did love the first time I heard it, or even something like Stella Blue or, you know, any of his ballad spots. And I think Black Peter is just, it's a song that you need to have a little more life experience to, or at least I needed to have more life experience to be able to fully understand. And I think coming to it through Birchfield's work and really thinking about what is going on in that painting, in this song, in this album, the cycles of nature that Hunter is returning to throughout these eight songs, it all finally clicked into place for me. And so I, you know, I do like the song Black Peter. And I have come to really like it by virtue of doing this book and thinking about it as an adult in a way that I never thought about it in beforehand. And even when I wasn't working on this, and all the time between 1995 and whenever I did this a couple of years ago, a few years ago, I just was in a different headspace. And to be able to, you know, hear this song and really think about it and think about it within the context of this painter's work, Charles Birchfield's work, it did just all come together for me. So I have a newfound appreciation for it. It certainly is of a piece with this album and with the songs. I mean, it is in a perfect spot on this album.
Well, I'm glad to hear this because I'd hate to have to end the podcast right here. We're so close. No, I wouldn't do that. But I am glad to hear that you've deepened your relationship with this song, because I think you're right that a young man who does not have much of a relationship with death, it maybe hasn't touched his life, is not as likely to understand this song as an older man. We know it's common in the Grateful Dead knowledge that a lot of American Beauty is about death and dying. But that stuff had begun to enter into their lives here. Garcia, of course, lost his father when he was young, and it's not a stranger to him. I think that I connected with it pretty early on, but my relationship to it has changed, deepened, I think, perhaps, because I mean, it's a deathbed blues. It's Hunter being Hunter, and a psychedelic writer, whether he would probably punch me for using the term, but and he'd be right to, time is an illusion. Time is slippery. And so every bed is a deathbed, depending on your perception, where you are, and how you think time is moving for you. And so this could connect to you as a young man, old man, but either way, this character is frozen by his ill health and gazing at the threshold where his mortality lurks. And this song, it properly told, which is many, many, many of the versions, can just really just send shivers down my spine. And I delight in that, because God, when Jerry would lay into this song, what a beauty. So speaking of laying into a song, let's get to our next one. And that was that's 122670 Legion Stadium, El Monte, California. I think I've played this on the show before as well. I know we talked about this show at some point when I think my friend Barnsey was on. I think this was on our like one-off venues episode, but we're not here to talk about that venue. We are here to talk about Pigpen and Easy Wind. And I don't have a lot of notes on that, on this particular song, but I think we can talk a lot about Pigpen. This is the clear evidence of that thing that people talked about of early Grateful Dead as being a many-headed beast. And, they pan the camera and Pigpen steps up and just takes charge of the band. Even though they're the same band, they're so different than what we were just hearing, or Uncle John's band, or most of these tracks. This one, and yet it fits.
It does. Well, it's you mentioned, Black Peter being a deathbed blues. This is, a country blues of cut from the cloth of Robert Johnson. And that's exactly what Hunter was trying to do in terms of the lyrics and the imagery of this. And of course, Pigpen was the swinging blues man in the band. He was the first and only front man for a while. And it is amazing how, the instrumentation on this album is more or less acoustic, except for Easy Wind, where this is the only song on the album where you even would ever think that there are not only one drummer, but two drummers playing. Because for the most part, the percussion is very light on this album. But here it is pounding away, and it is just a dun-dun. Yeah, it's just that, it's that blues walk that is unmistakable, and obviously drawing from a very established tradition. that the that Pigpen had been drawn to, you know, hanging out in East Palo Alto as a kid, and his dad is a DJ, jazz and blues DJ, on one of the stations down on the peninsula, and it's also that blues of that kind of prophetic blues that foretells a sad end, which, as we all know, is what happened with Pigpen. And it, you know, it's something else that it's amazing how little is still known about Pigpen in the grand scheme of things. You know, not even Dennis McNally has in his bio of the band has a whole lot to say about Pigpen or the, like really who he was. You know, and I was really fascinated by the letter I found that had been auctioned off on Christie's, which I had never really seen a lot. I never really had noticed anyone talking about this letter before. But it's this letter that he wrote to a girl in school in, I think 61.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just this kind of sappy, but one it's a sappy strong word. It's a teenager's crush being expressed, but in some pretty dark terms. And
I think it's kind of sophisticated, you know?
Well, it is. Yeah, it's, it is.
This is a guy who, like, I don't know what he was reading, but he you get sort of an innate sense that he's hip as he writes. Yeah, it's honestly, people should pick up the book for this alone. So I won't read it all or really any of it, but he writes about riding a motorcycle and hating himself for ever loving anyone. Like, oh my God. Yeah, this is just, you know, Pigpen is a tender hearted guy, and you listen to his songs and you can really hear it. Like, you hear it later in like Two Souls of Communion and stuff like that. I mean, the guy, he was and everybody who knew him would say, you know, oh, he's gruff and blah, blah, blah. You know, he drank a lot, but you know, he was a sweetheart. And, I think that you shine a nice light on that here.
Well, thank you. And I you know, there's this in the same way that the song is it's kind of a point of departure, for in terms of, you know, the context of the rest of the album, I also do that a bit with the writing style, especially in the opening of just trying to, and it's intentionally, I'm riffing on Tom Wolfe and the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and this kind of heightened, almost purple prose, that is trying to, make a point, but, you know, speaking to the traditions that are evident in this song and also of the cultural context, you know, everything going on around the band at the time and in the culture in general, because this is a great song and Pigpen is such a fascinating character. And I had embarked on this really thinking like, oh, I'm going to go deep into Pigpen, and it's hard to go deep into Pigpen. And it's, you go to the archives at UC Santa Cruz, there's not a whole lot there because the archives weren't really a thing when Pigpen was around. Or like the idea of keeping anything, there's no institutional memory to speak of, and the people, you know, who know him, they didn't really know him. He was a servant to the music. There's no doubt about that, and I think that's part of the soulfulness. And certainly, I would, you know, it would be amazing to know more about this guy. And I think some of the people who are still around who could do it, I hope they do someday. But I never kind of let go of the fact that, because I think McNally's book is about as perfect as a biography can be, or, you know, a comprehensive history of something like the Grateful Dead can be. And the fact that he doesn't go as deep in the Pigpen as he goes into so much else is telling.
Yeah, it just seems like it's not there, which is a shame. But you do a nice job here, and I would do a great disservice to just pull quotes. Yeah, this song is, I think, a lot like Pig, and I think Hunter really gets at it. And again, with Hunter's like ability to see the arc. In this case, he's looking ahead. You know, I live 5 years if I take my time. Mm-hmm. Like, that's prophetic.
Yeah.
And Pig is singing it himself. And, you know, it's tough and gone too soon. So the swagger that is in the song is just almost like defiance of the sad lyric that he's singing. Yeah. You know,
but that's the blues, you know, yeah. Right? That's the blues encapsulated.
And that's Pig.
Yeah.
All right. So we got one more. Should we go for it?
Let's do it. Yeah. We've come this far.
All right. That was Casey Jones. This, of course, is, you know, probably one of their more famous songs. It's a big number in the canon of drug songs in the Americas. And I think we have to talk about something that you go into pretty early in the chapter about the sniff, the very beginning of the song. Like Dennis McNally, who I never thought to ask about it because I'd never even considered it a sniff. I just like, you know, I feel like it's, you know, so I never connected it to cocaine. I just feel like it's just, you know, somebody taking a breath that just was captured by a hot mic and they just left it because it felt natural. And because it does, it feels like you're just sitting in the room right as that about to play. But yeah. Here we go. High on cocaine.
Yeah. Well, at least not on this track, but it's funny, you know, I guess tells you something about where my head was at, all these years, but I always imagined it just being this cutesy, like, you know, between takes, like, here we go. And it's just something they kept in there, but I did want to ask about it because it's to me, it was something more than a breath picked up on a hot mic. It was obviously intentional because it's there, you know, whatever it was.
Somebody chose to leave it there.
Yeah. But yeah, it was amazing to start asking around and no one had anything until I asked Bob Matthews about it. And he gave me that great answer, but I was like, it's the dumbest thing I ever did. You know, I thought I was being cute. And I'm so sick of, I've heard that so many times and I regret it every time I hear it. And I think it also, because, you know, you're right. And absolutely. It's one of the quintessential drug songs, but it's an anti-drug song in some ways, you know, you know, we got two good eyes, but we still don't see that. That's Hunter saying, here's where we're going. We're on this ride. We're on this train. And we know what happened to the original Casey Jones. And here we go, nonetheless. And that's what this song is really about. It's about forging ahead, even if you know you shouldn't, or you should maybe be doing it a slightly different way. Which is certainly where the dead were at this juncture, and it's kind of a pretty good metaphor for the Grateful Dead in the 1970s.
And we must press on in the face of danger. We must press on against all resistance, and so they do. I like that. It's like, you know, not Casey Jones, stop doing that. It's just watch your speed.
Yeah.
Moderation in all things. It's the middle path is really what he's hinting at there. I think it's worth mentioning that this song, the story of this song ties a reference to the old story of Casey Jones, but it is a very different song from the Ballad of Casey Jones, which the Grateful Dead did play. They played it twice. And Jerry played it in acoustic gigs, actually, from 82 with like Garcia Khan. Most of the times he played it was with the Jerry Acoustic Band, and I think he even played it in 92 with Garcia Grisman. But very, very different song. And I kind of feel like by the time he's playing it in 92 with Grizz, he's just messing with us. But later that year, they brought it back with the Grateful Dead, and I hadn't played it for quite a few years, and at RFK. And I was there. We talked about this on a show last fall, I think. And it was a lot of fun to see. And they
came out of that's out of space, right? Mickey had the horn.
They're playing like Shenandoah or something in space, and then Mickey rolls out with the great big horn and scares the shit out of the entire stadium. And then they play Casey Jones. They start playing Casey Jones a little slow, and then they give a couple little toots from that horn again, and there we are. Casey Jones is back.
Yeah.
Watch your speed. And what a killer song. And another one of those on the FCC don't play list. So of course it got played. Probably one of the handful of first songs most people heard as they became Dead fans, because of probably partially because of the FCC resistance, and also because it's just a catchy damn song.
It is very, very catchy. I think what you just said about Casey Jones is, you're right. It's not about saying no, because again, that's something the Grateful Dead didn't want to do. They didn't want to say no to anything. They didn't want to enforce anything. They didn't want to be cops. They didn't want to be enforcers. But this is a warning to watch the excess and to really understand that this thing being the Grateful Dead is gaining momentum, and that if we, the Grateful Dead, are not careful, and those around them, that they will, you know, it could go off the rails. And Hunter absolutely recognized that. And I think, you know, the magic of that Garcia Hunter relationship is that on some level, Jerry absolutely, you know, he really put this all out into the world in a way that he was feeling it as well, and that there was he was not in denial about any of this stuff. What he expressed was as authentic and as genuine as a vehicle for Hunter's lyrics. And it is amazing, and that's why it is such powerful music, because he's living it.
Yeah, he's driving that train, or at least riding into the caboose, depending on what the jam is of the day. But either way, it's just, you know, Hunter's just there like, just be cool, man.
Yeah.
Just take it easy. And they did in fits and spurts. But, you know, I say all things moderation, but even moderation should be taken in moderation at times.
Right. So, right. And
the Dead definitely knew that.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, I think the Hunter seems to pin the real good times ending sometime, you know, post Europe 72. So we're still a little bit away from that. But again, the fact that we can have these conversations so far after the fact, and that they ring true, that you understand that this is great art, in that it transcends time and culture and cultural context to be alive in the moment. And that's what all of us who have found worth and meaning in this music, that's what we're all, I think, attracted to in our own ways, is that ability to have this mean something new every time. And it never grows old, and why we can listen to all these versions of all these eight songs and find something new and exciting in so many of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you just capped it there beautifully. So, I think what we'll do is we'll go ahead and leave it there. And we'll play a little mix of this side two songs. We're gonna run the gamut in years. I think we're gonna get all the way up into the 1980 somethings, and with some of these versions. So I hope everybody likes them. Buzz, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking with me for these two episodes. Again, the book is, you can find it on the website. I'll link to it all, but it's called Working Man's Dead by Buzz Poole. And it's on the 33 and a third series. You can get it at all the usual book places. We'll find some links to share with everyone. And thank you so much for coming on. You have to come back and just talk about, like, you know, other Grateful Dead stuff sometime, if you like.
I'd be happy to. Thank you for having me, Jonathan. And yeah, anytime, especially these days, I'm around.
Right. Aren't we all?
Yeah, we are.
All right, man. Thank you so much. And happy 50th Working Man's Dead.
Happy 50th Working Man's Dead.
All right.
Sun is getting hot. I can't help you with your trouble. You won't help with mine. I gotta get down to says quarter to eight, get me up till four. I gotta get down, I gotta get down, or I can't work there no more. Poor man make a $5 bill, keep him happy all the time. Some other brother making nothing at all, and you can hear him cry. Then I go, buddy, then I go now. Take your shift out the mine.
Gotta get down to the Cumberland Mine.
Gotta get down to the Cumberland Mine.
That's where I made me spend my time.
Making money, $5.
was day. Made it on my move away. Poor man got to come to hand blue. He can't win for losing. Got a poor man got to walk the line just to pay his union due. I don't know now, just don't know if I'm going back in. I don't know now, just don't know if I'm going back in. Just then the wind came squalling through the door, but who can the weather command? Just wanna have a little peace to die and a friend or two I love at hand. Roll on up on a roll back down.
one more day I find myself alive. Tomorrow maybe go beneath the ground. To this day, and it's just like any other day that's ever been. Sun going up and then the sun it going down, shine through my window, and my friends they come around, come around, come around. Don't care. That a man could be as poor as me. Take a look at poor Peter. He's lying in pain. Now let's go run and see. Run and see. Run and see.
Got a case of broken strings. That isn't to say that we got a whole case full of broken strings, but we got a case that is like a, anyway, we got a broken string, and so we're gonna fix it, and you can watch our dust.
A fire day. There's a whole lot of women out in red on the streets today. And the river keeps on talking, but you never hear the word it says. settled in another room. I live 5 years if I take my time. Fall in love, check, I'm drinking my wine. Easy win. Growing course, I'll buy you today.
Thank you.
out of 17. Cause I'm a slow jack baller and my heart is true. And I kill a devil better than I got my youth. Yes, I will. Easy whip. Blowing across a bayou today. You never had a word to say.
Jones. just crossed my mind.
Yeah.